Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
The Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network is brought to you by Go Wild. Now, if you haven't heard of Go Wild already, you need to check it out. You can find it on your app store, wherever you get your smartphone apps, or you can visit the desktop site at timetogowild.com. All Go Wild is a it's a social media platform designed for outdoorsmen and women. It has everything from camping content to hunting, to fishing, to wild game recipes, pretty much anything you could possibly ask for. There's content there and people putting content on Go Wild who are interested in whatever outdoor activities you're interested in. Go Wild is one of my favorite places to just spend time, to waste time, to spend time talking to people who are like-minded. It's a blast. You need to check it out. That's Go Wild, timetogowild.com. Check it out. Welcome to the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Parker McDonald, and this is episode number 87. Today, we are continuing the Local Legend series with one of my favorite legends that we have ever talked to, probably one of my favorite podcasts that we've ever recorded. His name is Bobby Worthington, and he's from Tennessee. We talk about a ton of things, so much that I can't even confine it to one subject. It's so stinking good. You guys stay tuned. This is a great episode. This is the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. I am excited about today, and let me tell you why. We have got probably my favorite guest that we have ever talked to, and I mean, that is not at all a dig at any of our past guests. We have got some great guests on the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast, but this guy is so knowledgeable. Within 10 minutes of talking to him, you're already going to be like, holy cow, I feel like I've learned something. There's just so much meat and potatoes in this episode that I think you're going to like it. I really think you're going to like it. I want to encourage everybody listening to this to take notes. I'm just giving you a warning. You're going to get to the end of these podcasts and you're going to be like, holy crap, I can't even remember everything that I learned in that because there was so much. I'm telling you, take notes. Get out a notepad, take notes on your phone, whatever you got to do. This is good stuff. I'm telling you, I'm immersed in this world, in the hunting world. I see stuff about it every day. I hear and listen to some of the greatest minds in the hunting industry. And this guy is in the top. This is Bobby Worthington. He's from Tennessee. And he's in the top. He's an outdoor writer. He's written for North American Whitetail. He's written his own books. I believe he said he's got 6 bucks that have been featured in North American Whitetail, which is the most of any person, of any single person. It's incredible. And he's also a world champion traditional archer, which is even cooler. Like, it makes him so much cooler, even already than what he what I told you at first about all the deer that he's killed and the big bucks that he's killed. Just to add to that, he's a world champion archer, which is freaking awesome. He is I really can't confine this episode into one specific subject matter. It's just that good. And that's why I'm telling you, you need to take notes. Like, I can't stress that enough. I took notes myself. But I'm going to tell you this. This is a 2-part podcast with Bobby. We're going to release the second part later on in the week. There was just so much. We were an hour and a half into the episode and really not even close to done. And so we decided to just make it a 2-part series. So make sure you tune into the next episode of Southern Ground Hunting Podcast to listen to the whole thing. You're not going to be upset by listening to this one right now, though. I can promise you that. It's actually probably a little bit better for you to be able to process the things that he said and have a few days to process it before you listen to the next part. I'm just being honest with you guys. This is an incredible episode. But before we get into the episode, I wanted to remind you that we are giving away a tethered Phantom saddle. All you have to do is subscribe to the Southern Ground Hunting channel on YouTube. That's all you got to do. It's pretty easy for you to do. Go do that. You'll be entered to win a tethered Phantom. If you already own a tethered Phantom and you're like, Parker, I really don't need a tethered Phantom, here's the good thing, is they can resell for a lot of money. So you can make money. We could potentially just be putting cash in your pocket if you've already got a saddle that you're happy with, or if you've already got a tethered Phantom. Listen, I'm just trying to help you guys out. And all you got to do is just this tiny little favor of subscribing to the Southern Ground Hunting channel on YouTube. That's all you got to do. So go and do that. Also, in that same vein, you can view. I'm right now putting up a bunch of old videos on the new YouTube channel. If this is the first podcast you've listened to in a while, maybe you don't know that we have moved all of our YouTube content to our own channel, which is the Southern Ground Hunting channel on YouTube. You can find everything there. I'm actually in the process right now. This week, I've been uploading all of the videos from the 2018 season, which was one of the funnest seasons that I've ever had. So you can look at it there on YouTube and watch all those videos. If you've seen them, it is definitely a blast from the past if you've already watched them whenever they were first released 2 years ago. But I've really enjoyed rewatching them, really. It brought back so many memories, and maybe you will too. I hope you do. So you can go check that out on YouTube. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Southern Ground Hunting. Yeah, I don't really have any other announcements for you guys that you need to know. So this is a longer episode, but it is so stinking good. You're going to get to the end of it and you're going to be like, I feel like we just started. you can realize that you've been sitting there for almost 2 hours. So let's get into this episode. This is Local Legends with Bobby Worthington. All right, everybody. I am extremely excited about this episode today. In fact, I believe, Drew, I don't know about you, man, but I think it's probably going to be one of my favorite episodes that we have ever done. And that's just basing on the phone calls that I've had with our guest to this point.
Yeah, man. Parker, I'm so jacked. I actually bought one of his books and have dove into that. So, man, I'm just so excited to hear from our guest today, man.
So let's get into this. We have got on the phone our local legend for this week, Mr. Bobby Worthington from Tennessee. Bobby, how's it going?
It's going great. I appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity to speak a little bit on deer hunting.
Well, we're more excited. Like I've been excited for a month about this since somebody told me and recommended you to me. And I did some digging and I found some really impressive stuff and finally came across your phone number through a mutual acquaintance and gave you a call. And we talked, I don't know if you remember this, Bobby, but we talked for a good 35 minutes. And I wished that I had just pressed record on my phone after that conversation, because I was like, that would have been an excellent podcast right there. But I'm really excited about it. And I know Drew is. It's not every day that you run across somebody in the South who has the resume that you do. And so I'm really excited to get into the meat and potatoes of all this. But if you could, Bobby, could you just kind of give us a brief summary of yourself, where you live, what you do, how you got into hunting and things like that?
Yeah, I live in a rural area in Southeast Tennessee, live on the Cumberland Plateau, and then there's the Sasquatchie Valley, and then on the other side is Waldron's Ridge, and it forms this valley that's about 100 miles long. It's pretty well known. It's one of the only geographical features they say you can see from outer space. My family moved into Bledsoe County in 1804, and I've got deep roots here, and I've been here all my life, and I grew up in a very rural area, and we didn't have a whole lot, and I got into deer hunting young in life. My dad actually told stories that there weren't any deer here when he was growing up, and there were very few in this county when I was a young man and wanted to start hunting. We actually had to travel and go to some public hunting areas to be able to hunt, but the population, like most places, has been since then. But back in the 60s and 70s when I first started hunting, we were kind of in the restoration movement. You know, you didn't shoot any does, and you let them populate, and the state game of fish done a good job with that, as they did in most states, and we've got a good deer hunting population now. And I just went through the stage like most people. At first, of course, I was bow hunting, never did care to gun hunt deer. And I bow hunted rabbits, and about everything I've done with a bow. I've always had a passion for archery, and grew up shooting my first deer was the first challenge. And then after that, of course, like most people, I wanted to shoot as many as legally possible. Then I wanted to shoot a buck. Then the trophy bug hit me. I got to reading North American Whitetail Magazine and some other magazines in the 80s. I think I started reading it as soon as it came on the market. And I was just fascinated by the big deer people had and had in that magazine. And finally, I figured it out and started killing some of your bucks. And went from there.
So whenever you started, and specifically kind of talking about when you started really targeting mature deer, how long did it take you to first off, how long did it take you to make that happen and start really putting the pieces together? And you say everybody gets lucky every once in a while, but it turns into a different thing when you really start being able to consistently get on mature animals. At what age and at what point in your hunting, I guess, career, did you start realizing that that was something that you wanted to do?
Well, killing deer, I was raised in the woods. I live further back more in the woods than most people do when they go camping. Just very rural area, and I live in a rustic home, and I always have. And for entertainment at night, we would sit around and poke the chickens on the roost. And today we watch them peck and scratch through the cracks in our floor, and we couldn't afford a TV. I remember the first TV coming to my home, we just got out in the woods and stayed in the woods. And I learned early on how wildlife use terrain features to travel, paths. And I was always fascinated with why paths were in the place they were, and that really, when you get down to it, is one of the big keys to trophy hunting. And when I first started reading North American Whitetail magazine, I started seeing the huge ducks that were being killed in the Midwest, particularly back then, most of them were killed in Illinois. And it just, I realized that in Tennessee, even the monster ducks that most people were killing were not what I consider a trophy anymore, because of the 180 and 190, 200 steer I saw in North America. So I got to call in public hunting areas up in 87. I got to call in a lot of public hunting areas up in Illinois, trying to talk to managers, pinpoint places that I might go. Of course, we use paper mounts back in the travel with. I draw out the directions on the mount and pick off the first year and hunted some public ground. I had an opportunity to shoot a big deer, but it got away from me. And then the second year, I went to Siloam Springs State Park. Killed a really big non-pit that got a lot of notoriety. And a gentleman wrote an article for North American Whitetail magazine about that deer. It came out at night, and that was the first published article I ever had. And then from then to about 2000, I killed a few respectable deer for Tennessee. Traveled a few times to the Midwest, but I didn't have the finances to travel much. And I've always worked one and a lot of times two jobs. And finally, in 2000, I went back to another public area, the eastern part of the state. I killed a giant 180. It's basically 8 points scored in the 180s. His main time run from 12 and a half to 15 inches, 15 and a quarter, actually.
Ooh, man.
And I never did like the story that was written about the first deer, so I wrote that story myself. And when I wrote that, Gordon Whittaker of North American Whitetail magazine asked me to start writing how-to stories, because inside the story I injected quite a bit of how-to information. And then a lot of other publications followed and asked me to start writing. So I wrote North American Whitetail Deer and Deer Hunting and several other publications, which is pretty amazing. I was pretty ignorant in school. It took me 8 classes of English to get out of high school. I had to take summer school every year. It was just awful. Man, I'm still not very good. I still hardly spell my last name, but I tell a story about running in, after I wrote my first book. North American Whitetail Magazine eventually asked me to write a book. It's the only hunting book they've ever published. I wrote it, Bow Hunt Trophy Whitetail. I run into one of my English teachers. Of course, she was quite elderly after I wrote that book. And we got to talking about school and my problems in English. And I told her I wanted to tell her something, that I had written a book. She got all excited and wanted to know how many pages it was, what the subject was, how long it took me. And as we talked, I realized she thought I said I had read a book. She was pretty excited about that. But that started in 2000. That one big deer started my writing career, and I started writing articles regular and ended up writing a book for North American Whitetail. And then I co-authored a few. Then I wrote a second book, A Passionate Quest for Phantoms of the Forest, which is no longer in print. I do have a volume 2 of that on my computer. I hope next year to get it printed. But I'm excited about it. It's probably about 100 pages from the first one.
That's really cool. Drew actually purchased the book, as he mentioned, the bow hunting trophy whitetails.
Yes.
And Drew, why don't you tell us your first impressions of this book? I know it's intimidating for me as a host, just hosting this podcast after you know, learning and talking with Bobby for, you know, a couple conversations, it's intimidating for me. I'm like, man, how are we going to possibly do this guy justice? Like, he's just an absolutely incredible guest to have. What are your first impressions of the book? And I guess just to even encourage readers to go or listeners to go and buy this book for themselves.
Yeah. My first impression of it is when you see it, it's got a big buck there on the front cover, and you open it up and you're thinking you're going to jump right into, Mr. Bobby sitting in the stand, and you don't. You actually jump into knowing your equipment, which I really appreciated, because I know for a large portion of my archery life, it was just, hey, let me go shoot a couple days for season, and then let me hop in a stand, and then I'll be good to go. So you actually jump in and you start reading about how to execute your shot, learning your equipment, really kind of archery in and out. And I really appreciate that. And then you jump into, right after that, you jump into, I'm halfway through it. And so you jump into, a heartbreaking story, Mr. Bobby, as I was reading the story of that big deer that you missed, man, I get upset when I miss a 100-inch buck. I couldn't imagine a 190, 200-inch monster. You know, and so it's a great read. It's straightforward. It's my type of reading. Anybody can benefit from this book, whether you've been hunting one day or whether you've been hunting 50 years, you can benefit from it. I encourage anybody to go pick it up.
That's really cool. That's amazing. And so, using that as kind of a segue into the next portion of what I kind of want to talk about to get to know Bobby a little bit before we get into the meat and potatoes, I guess, of the podcast, because guys listening to this, I promise you there are meat and potatoes in this podcast. And if you don't like meat and potatoes, then insert whatever it is that you like, because this is a good, I'm telling you, it's going to be a solid episode. But I wanted to ask you about this, Bobby. I know a big part of what you do and a big part of your accomplishments even has been in the archery world. Can you talk about that for just a second?
Oh, yeah, I've always shot competition on the state level since I was young and got into 3D archery a little bit with a compound. But about five and a half years ago, decided to get back into traditional archery. I stuck with it a while, not as long as Gene and Barry Winston and Roger Roth. They're all friends of mine, and we all shot, continued to hunt with traditional even after compounds came out. Most of us started shooting compound for a little while and went back to traditional. Then I started shooting compounds more. And then about five and a half, 6 years ago, I got into national and world level on traditional archery, shooting a recurve in the traditional RU class. That's a recurve with fingers, of course, and no sight. And I've done that now I just had a competition this past weekend, actually the traditional world championship in Clarksville, Tennessee. But I've done that for a few years now, and I really enjoy it. I took about a year and a half break. I got Rocky Mountain spotted tick fever, and it messed with my eyes some, and some other things, and I just took a little break from it. But this past weekend's the first tournament in over a year, but I really enjoyed it.
And how did you do in the tournament this weekend?
I placed first in my place.
and you mentioned something too, that maybe there were some records or something that happened during that during this tournament.
Well, yeah, there was. I went back and checked. That's the highest score shot in my class by 22 points. But you know, there's some real good shooters out there now, and there's some that's hard to compete again right now. Yeah,
that's so cool.
Consider all this.
That's so cool. And now, how many archery competitions have you actually won since you started doing it?
I think that's my sixth world championship, and I've won 18 national championships. Oof. So far.
Wow.
Man, that's incredible.
That's really cool. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I struggle just to win a game of Words with Friends. Like, I can imagine. I can't imagine winning that. That's...
I would struggle at that or Scramble, either one. To tell you the truth.
Listen, God made some of us better at some things than others, you know, and he just made you a good deer hunter and a good archer. That's okay. That's fine.
I think that's about it. I do enjoy those two things.
That's so cool. So speaking of that, when did you start doing the traditional archery thing? You may have already mentioned it. I may have missed it. When did you start doing that as far as hunting with traditional archery equipment?
I still hunt with it occasionally. It's according to the setup. Back in 2000, I missed a big deer that your partner there mentioned, and it was a world-class deer, probably a new world record typical. It was in Iowa, and I missed him with a recurve, and up until that point, I'd done most of my hunting with a recurve, and I missed him, and I put it down for a while and started shooting compounds. It's too hard and too expensive to spend years hunting thick with deer and traveling out of state and everything, and to have a deer like that in bow range, and you can take a compound and shoot his heart out, and with a recurve, I couldn't accomplish what I was doing. Now, back then, I wasn't at the level I am now with a recurve, and neither was the industry. Back then, we would cut the arrows off at the back of our bow, and we would shoot split fingers. And those two things is why I missed that big deer. I shoot a what you call gap shoot. Some people might refer to it as split vision, but I look at the gap, the distance between the tip of my arrow and the subject I want to hit, the target. And that big deer was on the trail on the funnel I intended for him to be, and was coming down, and I would have killed him. He was probably 20 yards away. He was a 6x6. This G4 is probably 9 or 10 inches long. It's a big time. Pure typical. His rack was big. He actually looked one of them odd things that the rack looks closer to you than the deer. It don't look like it belongs to the deer. Amazing mainframe deer. But if he'd have stayed on that trail, I'd have got him. But there were some rubs that had been made the night before right under my tree, and I seen them when I climbed up. They were small, but for some reason, he wanted to come over and smell them rubs, and he ended up 5 yards from me. And because I didn't have full-length arrows, and I shot split fingers, I don't know if you understand this or not, but to get low enough to hit him at 5 yards with my arrow tip, I lost my arrow on my peripheral vision, and I knew I had no idea where it would end up. My point on was the arrow cut off the back of my bow and split fingers. My point on was probably 30 or 35 yards, and anywhere inside that, probably 20. My arrow would have been close enough to the intended mark. I could have seen it, but when he got that close, I shot my arrow down so far that I lost my arrow. And that's basically why I didn't kill that deer, and I took for many years. But now we shoot, most archers shoot 3 fingers under, and we use full-length arrows, so at any distance, our arrow does not leave our peripheral vision, and it helps in the aim process.
Sure.
I hope I haven't made that too confusing.
No.
You just made my stomach hurt for you. That's rough, man.
I still bow hunt. It's according. I bow hunt with recurve some and a compound some, and it's if the setup's not, if I can't funnel the deer quite as tight as I want, then I will hunt with my compound. Like I said, it's still legal, and it's still a good sport. And to kill a 180-inch deer with a compound, still quite an accomplishment. Generally, I know right where the deer is. I don't bet on luck. Bow hunt's a game of chance, but I figured that out. It's no longer a mystery to me, and I know generally where the deer I want to be shooting will be standing when I kill it. So I set up appropriately. But sometimes there's not a tree, or the terrain won't get me won't let me get quite as close as I would want with a recurve. I try to be ethical about it. And if the shot's pushed out there beyond 20 yards, a lot of times I'll use my compound.
Yeah.
The time I shoot a deer that I'm not after, or any time I shoot a deer that's not standing where I thought he'd be standing, it's just, I count it as a luck deer to me, but that hardly ever happens. There was a deer I killed named Rattlesnake that was featured in North American Whitetail Magazine. And when the deer was 3.5 years old, I told my son, Clay, I told him where the deer would be standing when I killed him a few years later when he got material and got to the point I wanted him. Within 6 feet of where I pointed to the ground, that deer was standing when I killed him 4 years later when he was 7.5 years old.
Mr. Bobby, that's crazy. That's awesome. That is so cool.
When you figure it out, you know, it's not that big of a mystery no more, you know.
That's so cool.
That's really neat. I wish I could call you.
You do everything you can to put the odds in your favor, and if it don't happen, then there's nothing more you can do to control it. And most of the time, though, it will happen. If you get to hunt enough. So it's just a game of chance, and you finally learn. A lot of people talk about getting inside a whitetail or understanding what they're thinking or what they're going to do next. A dog can't understand a cat, and a man can't understand a whitetail. We're different creatures with different minds and different mindsets and different thinkings completely. But there's things you can do. It's a game of chance. If you're a poker player, a professional poker player, it's no longer a mystery to them. They understand everything. But whether they win or not is part of the game is controlling their opponent, which they cannot do. Even though they put everything in their odds, most of the time they will. And if it's not another professional they're playing against, they don't understand how to play the game, then they will win every time.
I've never heard it put like that.
I love that.
But I'm going to take it even a step further. You said a dog don't understand a cat, and a man don't understand a deer. Just take it even a step further. A man doesn't even understand a woman. So there's no way we could possibly completely understand what a deer is going to do. And what you said about it being, you know, you can't control your opponent. You can just do everything that you possibly can to put yourself and to play the game as well as you can. And so now I want to get into the meat and potatoes. I want you to talk to us, Bobby, about how you put yourself in those positions where you feel like you are doing everything that you can to make those things happen. Because the things that you're talking about right now are, I mean, it's next level stuff, honestly. Drew, I know you probably agree. Like you're sitting here talking about 180-inch deer. I'm like, what about like 115 or 120? Like that's the level that a lot of guys are on right now, where we're not even thinking about, you know, these true giants. And so, Bobby, if you could, I'm just gonna let you take it away, and you tell us how are you doing this? How are you able to understand deer on this level?
Well, let me back up just a little, and when I was talking about the game of chance, let me elaborate a little more, then I will get into the meat and potatoes of it. You got two professional poker players. I've never used this analogy before. As a matter of fact, I just now thought about it. But if you've got two professional poker players, and they're both professional, they understand the game completely, and then it's just you and your opponent and your move against his. The same way with white-tailed deer, and I'll tell you why we don't, even those that do truly understand. I believe 90% of the mature bucks is legally killed by 5% of the white-tailed hunters that finally understand what's important. And they may not organize their thoughts into words like in a book like I have, but they understand it. But even it's a game of chance anyway. The best I can do, I normally kill the buck I want. He's normally standing where I think he will be, and I kill him generally when I think I will. But here's one reason that does not happen occasionally with me and some other deer hunters that are probably a lot better now. The buck, mature bucks, and a lot of deer hunters don't even understand this, a lot of professionals don't. I believe they have two home ranges. And you may put the odds in your favor 100% by hunting the one tree that he walks by more than any other tree in the woods when he is at home. But if he spends his rut at another home range, I don't care how skilled you are. I don't care how you are in the correct place 100% of the time and spend a month there, you will not kill him. And a lot of hunters begin to question their skill or begin to doubt their self maybe after a week or a few days, and they'll get down and start walking and looking and scouting more when they were in the one tree that he walks by more than any other when he is at home. I wrote about this pretty extensively in North American Whitetail Magazine. Me and Gene Lindsay, Barry, and Roger Rother have knocked this around quite a bit, and they agree 100% with my assessment when I wrote the articles. I believe a lot of ducks have two home ranges. So if you're set up tight and you're set up on that deer and you're not seeing him, and used to, all we had to go by was sign when I first started this stuff. I didn't have trail cameras, but when his sign dried up and his track was not showing up in his straights and the sign dried up, I knew that deer was gone. I just had a feeling then something happened later on that confirmed that. But understand that you got to give your stand time to work. I believe a deer, when they're born, of course, most people know when they get a year and a half old, they get cast out by the old doe, they dissipate, and they go find their own home range. They may travel 2 miles, normally 5 or 6 miles, and set up a new home range, a new area. And I honestly believe that when those deer get 4.5 or 5.5 years old, they will start moving back to their birth home range. It's already imprinted in their mind. They follow their mother there around in that area for a year or more, and it's already imprinted in their mind. And I believe they go back and they start spending a part of their time back and forth between the two home ranges. And radio tracking here in the last year or two, I read some reports that show that same thing. And it may be 3 or 4 miles apart. So two things I want to make, two observations I will make. If you're set up tight and you feel like you're tight and in the right location, it's a game of chance. But if you put everything in your odds on that deer, and you know you have confidence in that stand and keep after him. When he returns, if you're set up correctly, he will come to your stand. But he may not be there at the time. You may hear of him getting killed 4 or 5 miles away, as some people do, a deer they was hunting. And that's what happened. He got killed in the other home range. Another observation is, I believe the old doe cats, they're falling out. It's by nature, they say it's inbreed, and I'm still of an eye about some of that. But if that's the case, and it looks to me like it is, if you shoot the doe, say you've got a doe comes under you with 2 button bucks, and it's legal, and you harvest her, both of those button bucks will probably remain in that home range all their life, and they will be much easier to kill. I've hunted several bucks. Most of them had two home ranges. One particular I know did not. And that year I harvested some does pretty heavily, and I think I had killed that button buck's mother when it was in the fall when it was young. So that's two observations on that. You fellas got any comments or questions about that for us?
My mind's blown, man. That's all, like, that is so good. Like,
never thought of that.
Never thought of it. Yeah, no.
But it makes total sense. Oh my goodness.
So that is something, especially for guys who are hunting some private land, even like when you can really start keeping tabs on deer. I have often seen where I've killed a buck or killed a doe that had fawns, where you know if you kill the doe, the fawns will stick around there. And if you can start really keeping tabs on those deer, say you do harvest a doe with fawns, you start keeping tabs on those deer, that makes total sense to me. I would be interested to know. I know you said that's an observation and you had seen some stuff that had recently come out that kind of agreed with that observation. I would be interested to know more about that, I think. I don't know. Like, I don't even know where to go from there. Like, that is so good.
Mr. Bobby, one of the questions that I had was when you're talking about the two ranges, Are you talking about one being a rut range, or are you talking about a deer having a birth range where they were born at, and then they have their adult range, or is there a rut range too? Does that make sense?
Well, that's what forms the two home ranges, the birth range, where it was born and spent a year or so of its life, and then it dissipated, got cast out.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went to what you could call an adult home range. I call it a secondary home range.
Mm-hmm.
And then as that buck gets mature and that old doe that cast it out is no longer an issue, and maybe because of a lack of does or even hunting pressure, or maybe a more mature buck moves in, and that deer will take off, and he'll go back to the home range that he knows, where it was imprinted in his mind. He usually don't do that right off. I think he's 3 or 4 years old before he does that.
Okay.
And then he will start moving back and forth. He can move back and forth because of availability of does or hunting pressure.
Okay. All right.
He's got a place to go when that happens. As a matter of fact, two or three instances I've heard of friends of mine killing bucks and them traveling in a straight line, 3 or 4 miles before they die, in a straight line. And then maybe shot in the intestines or something, bed down and die. And I believe they went to their other home range because that shot spooked them and they died. And they didn't circle. They didn't travel around in their home range, which is generally a 3/4 mile by mile. They went straight to the other home range and they died there. And I know you all read or heard stories about a big buck with a certain rat characteristic being killed mm-hmm. 3 or 4 miles, 5 miles from where the guy knowed he had seen him or got his picture. That deer was either killed on the travel corridor between the home ranges or in its secondary home range. And I've seen them spend the summer in one home range and go for the rut in the other one. Probably the availability of does does that, or hunting pressure and vice versa. But I also had one buck that I had a friend of mine that could keep tabs on him for me. He's seen him in a clear cut a lot, about 4 miles from my house. And that deer moved back and forth. The longest he was gone was about a month. In the winter, but he would move sometimes within a couple of nights, he would move back and forth. So it depends a lot on things that we can't understand, not being that particular deer. And maybe another deer couldn't even understand what was causing that.
Yeah.
That is good. That's good stuff. So I really don't have, like, that kind of just
blows meat potatoes, man.
Yeah. That just kind of blows my mind. Let's just keep going, man. So you talked about. Go ahead.
Well, let me say, the most difficult things for most inspiring bow hunters is to understand what's important and what's not important. Most do not. Most are wasting all their time dealing with, worrying about, working on, and buying things that will not help them one bit. And that's why they end up at the end of the year frustrated like they have so many other years. There are things that we do not know in life, and there are things that we realize we do not know. The difference in these two things is really profound and broad in scope, and they really affect all the avenues of our life. Over the years, it's become apparent that the most difficult thing for inspiring trophy bow hunters is to understand what is significant to their success and what is not. A lot of hunters exert tremendous energy working on stuff, like I said, that really, really don't matter. Let me give you an analogy. I coach a lot of archery, and I shoot in a lot of different ranges. And in nearly every range I attend, there's individuals in nearly every range. They'll shoot arrows for a little while, and then they'll walk over to the paper rack and paper tune their bow. They'll shoot holes through paper. And then they'll start turning screws on their bow. They will repeat this over and over during the day if you watch them. And this they do in an attempt to improve their shooting by adjusting their bow. And it's obvious to me from watching most of these individuals that they have no idea how to execute a proper shot, making adjustments on their bow or adding new gimmicks to their bow, or buying a better, more advanced bow will not help them one iota. It won't help them a bit. And most of these individuals, really, they don't honestly know why their skill level is not where they would like it to be. the first thing they would have to do to improve their skill is learn to execute the shot. And then this takes time and effort. And it also takes knowledge of what they're missing. Same way most trophy deer hunters, they're majoring in minor things and minoring in major things. There is minor things that will, once you have the major things, once you learn to execute, a little adjustment or adding something different might help. But until you know how to execute a shot, or until you know how to kill a trophy buck, then all these little gimmicks people throw in the mix is nothing but cosmetic, is the way I look at it. They're really missing the big picture. So most of the questions I get about how to kill a big buck would be like a person who wanted to take up archery. Let's say someone hired me for an archery coach, and before their first lesson, they decided to go out and buy some equipment. And then the first question when on their phone to me was, what color of fletching should I put on my arrows? Well, that's not really important in the big scheme of how to execute a shot. You know, I can take the cheapest bow on the market and arrows with no fletching and show you how to execute. I can really show you how to execute with a rubber stretch band without a bow. I often laugh. It reminds me years ago, there's a wonderful show, I guess you guys seen it some, called Married with Children. I played probably the greatest show ever been on TV. I remember one time Al told Peggy, not long after computers come out, that they was going to get a computer. And his big red-headed wife got all excited and said, oh, Al, that is so wonderful. What color? it's about the same thing. So,
yeah. And I've found that to be true with a lot of deer hunting stuff, man. Like, a lot of people are asking so many questions, and they're wondering why they're not getting on deer. They're wondering why they're not being able to even see deer, let alone execute the shot. But that's the same people who are constantly learning, who are constantly not learning how to actually hunt, and more concerned with the gear that they're using, for sure.
Right, they're not concerned about the only one thing that will help them. Most bow hunters interested in shooting a buck are chasing rabbits down empty rabbit holes, and it's because they have no idea what an occupied rabbit hole looks like. This is really, it's in a big part to the commercialization of deer hunting. A lot of individuals get their information about how to kill a trophy buck from writers or from TV or internet stars. And I say stars in parentheses, whose livelihood depends on promoting techniques that are supported by products. And the sad truth is most of these products are gimmicks. They don't have one bit of bearing on your ability to kill mature bucks. What most individuals and even so-called experts are missing is the one important thing that will help you in any endeavor, and that's knowledge. There is only one way to improve your skill or to develop a skill in the first place, whether it's bow hunting, trophy bucks, or in any other endeavor, and that is to acquire new, more advanced knowledge than you already possess. This new knowledge must then be developed into skill once it's acquired, and knowledge can only be turned into skill one way, and that is through effort. I've often said, and sometimes me and others coaches put this on a bulletin board, without effort, something awful takes place in a person's life. Nothing. And so you have to first acquire the knowledge, and then you cannot be lazy with that knowledge, or it is useless. You have to develop that knowledge into skill. But the bad thing you got to realize is it's hard to promote and sell knowledge, which is the only thing that really increases your success. Most of the personalities who promote gimmicks are hunting on large private pieces of ground or they're that have unpressured deer, are really, you'd be surprised at the number of them that hunt in confinements in pens. And you can kill subtrophy deer, 150-inch deer in pens very cheap now. And a lot of the, not all of them, but a lot of the TV and internet personalities are doing this. So they can showcase their product, and it's just to make money for themselves. But I think there's sort of this prostitution of hunting, is that a lot of hunters don't understand what's important and what's not. They think buying more game, buying used bow, buying different tree stands, will increase their chances of success. And they'll get on the internet and they'll do this, and then they'll get on the internet and until late at night, talk to other so-called trophy hunters about, say, what constitutes a staging area, or which side of the tree is best to hang your stand on, and so forth. None of that amounts to a hill of beans, really. That's like a turning screws in a bow if you don't know how to execute the shot. A bow tuning is not going to help you one bit. And at the end of the season, they realize that once again, they did not shoot a trophy, just like in so many previous seasons. And why is this the case? They have really no idea why they didn't, other than maybe they think they didn't spend enough money or buy the right product. But yeah, that's not the case at all. They don't have a trophy, and the bottom line is they never put a trophy on their wall that season because one never stepped in front of them. They have everything in place. They know all the correct language and lingo, and they got the best bow, and they're ready for a nice picture. But they've spent way too much time working on and studying things that don't mount the hill of beans. And if they ever do kill a once-in-a-lifetime buck, it will truly be that, a once-in-a-lifetime buck, because it will solely be by luck. If a person kills a mature buck by luck, it cannot be repeated. However, if an individual shoots one on purpose, then he can do it again and again. That's why I said that probably 5% of the trophy hunters, or 10%, kill 90% of the big bucks, because we have figured it out. Like I said before, bow hunting trophy whitetail is a game of chance. The good news is there is ways to put the chance in our favor and increase our odds. Ultimately, there's just one challenge in trophy hunting mature bucks. The challenge is to find ways to increase your chances that a mature buck will walk within bow range of you during legal shooting hours. Now, the shooting part's important. You don't want that to happen too many times and you miss, but the shooting part, to me, is cosmetic, because if you don't get the buck in front of you, you can't kill it anyway. And there's smaller things, controlling your nerves and learning how to, when to draw and all that, but that's all cosmetic, because most people has got all that ready to go, but they just can't kill them because they can't get them there. Well, fellas, there's three elements that over the years I have learned that there's only three things that really matter. All the TV shows and internet chat and books ever written on bow hunting trophy whitetail don't amount to nothing if these three elements are not adhered to. That everything else is just cosmetic. Now, these elements don't have the fascination or the intrigue, maybe, as certain things that you want to talk about, like signpost rubs and a lot of things about the different scents deer puts in the scrape, and a lot of stuff that's intriguing, biological stuff to know about a deer, I guess. But these three simple elements are truly all that matters, and if you adhere to them, then each one of them will increase your chances of success. And let me outline them here. They're hunting during the rut. That's number one. Hunt a mature buck during the rut and not before the rut, and I will explain why. Number two is stand placement. There is one tree in the woods that your target buck or more mature bucks will walk past than any other tree. And it's your job to find that tree, and it can be found. And I will mention a few things on that. And the next is persistence, which is the amount of time you stand, you're in that stand. And I will have to say that persistence is the most important of the three. And I'll cover a few points on that. These three elements all accomplish the same thing. That is, they increase your odds, your chances that a mature buck or your target buck, whatever the situation may be, will walk by your stand within bow range. Let me show you how that is. If you're hunting outside the rut and you've got, let's say, I'm just thinking of something here off my head, but say that you've got a mature buck in your hunting area and you're hunting outside the rut. Say you're hunting October 1st, October 20th. During that time, he might be on his feet and walk through your hunting property one time. So if you're there for those 20 days, he might walk through your hunting property one time. Now, if you're not set up under the right tree, he won't come by you during that time. If you hunt half that time, you'll be there. Chances are half that you'll be there when he is. So that's one way. Now, stand placement. If you're hunting in a location where this buck walks through three quarters of his time, say it's a tight funnel and there is three or four corridors or deer trails that are forced because of a ditch or a body of water, forced to go around this particular spot and come under your stand, then let's say four corridors, then you increase your odds four times that that will happen, that a mature buck will walk by you. So if you're hunting during the rut, you're going to increase it 20 times, one day out of 20. If you're hunting in a tight funnel where four corridors come by, you're going to increase it four times dramatically than you would otherwise. And the next thing is persistence. If you're only hunting one day out of the 20 compared to 20 days out of the 20, you have increased your chances again 20 times. So all three of these do the same exact thing. They increase your odds that a mature buck will walk in front of you. So I can elaborate a little bit on all three if you would like me to.
Absolutely. Yes, please.
The first of these key points that I mentioned is hunting during the rut, and I want to point out the significance of that. Well, let me start out by relating to you a conversation I had a few years back. I was experiencing some knee pain one October, two or three years ago, so I went to see my doctor who is supposed to know something about knees, and he had a female intern doctor working with him, and she's the one that come in there and seen me, and it was obvious from her accent, she was from somewhere up the East Coast. And she said to me, "We'll need to do x-rays on your knee, Bobby. I hope you don't have to have surgery, but from an examination alone, I cannot be sure." And I answered, "Well, if I do have to have surgery, I'd have to wait till after the rut. In mind that it was already the first week of October." And she said, "Sure." And then she paused a minute and she looked at me over her glasses and asked, "What is a rut?" And I said, "Ma'am, that's the white-tailed deer breeding season." "Oh, of course," she said. She said, "I should have known that." And then she got to fidgeting around there with paperwork and just fidgeting around and in a kind of a daze. And the question that was growing in her mind got the best of her. And she blurted out, "And you're involved in that how, sir?" So I now know for sure I am correct in my assumption that there is still some people who do not understand the significance of hunting during the rut. She was one of them. Let's define the term rut for what me and when I use it in the terminology. I'm referring to a 25-day period of time during the late pre-rut and through the breeding season. This time frame I call the rut movement period, or I'll refer to it short as the rut. And as you probably realize, when dealing with mammals that are short day breeders in temperate regions, the timing of this period will vary depending on your location. This rut movement period, I think y'all are in, where y'all, Texas?
Alabama.
Alabama. Well, this disruptive period will take place at the same time basically every year where you live. Now, it may be more visible the color of the temperature. The time and primes deal, but the cold temperature is what I watch for when I decide when to take them a stand. But I'm not going to get off track too far here. And the reason that it stays the same wherever you're at is because the environmental condition that primes deer to breed for the rut is photoperiodism, which is the amount of daylight in a 24-hour period of time. So it enters the penal land and primes the deer for the breeding season. And this is through environment. You can transplant a deer from my region to your region, and the first year or two they may come in rut and breed at the time that is normal for up here. But over time, because of environment, of course, evolution, not Darwin's theory of evolution, but the true sense of adaptivity to your environment, because of that and them needing to adapt the fawn birth for the greatest time of survival, it will be keyed off photoperiodism, that their makeup, their biological makeup will learn when that is for best fawn survival. Now, where I live in southeastern Tennessee is just north of the 35th latitude. Actually, just about the southern part of Tennessee upward is the 35th latitude, up to the Canadian border, say. And the timing of the rut all through the Midwest is about the same at this place. Anywhere you live and hunt, you need to find out where that is. And most avid hunters know when the rut takes place for their location. But there's a period of about 25 days. And in my area through the Midwest up to Canada, it begins about October 25th. Now, if it's other than the exception of one buck, which I will discuss later, October 25th is the date that I killed. I've only killed mature bucks from that date forward as far as being pulled by the rut. Now, there's a few exceptions to that I will talk about. But only I'll start hunting mature bucks if I've got a big buck pinpointed and a buck I want to shoot. I will start hunting him October 25th or later, depending on the temperature. Daylight temperature is more important than most people realize. If it's unseasonably warm, October 25th through the 1st of November, I will stay out of his core area. He will still be coming through. If I've got him pinpointed and got the tree pinpointed, he'll be coming through, but it will be at night. And if I get in there when he is still coming through at night, if it's unseasonably warm, I will educate him. It wouldn't be no difference than me having him pinpointed, but starting to hunt him in the middle of October when he is nocturnal until the rut, which 90% of them are. So when I say October 25th forward is when the rut movement period, when I will hunt a mature buck, I am talking about only if the temperature is seasonal or below. If it's unseasonably warm, I still will not hunt them at that early date. Now, I realize that there are a lot of hunters hunting in special situations. We see it on TV. They've got huge tracts of unpressured ground. They don't go into the woods at all and bother the deer. And those deer are not what I call natural deer that's been pursued by the human predator. Most places I hunt's public ground or pressured private ground, like most individual that's probably going to listen to this podcast. So that is the situation I'm governed to hunting toward because most of us, now I'm not saying a thing in the world about the people that's worked hard and been able to buy and purchase these large pieces of ground or has unique situations to hunt. I'm tickled to death for them and I'm happy for them. But most of us just don't have that situation available to us. And as I said before, a lot of people now are hunting shows or killing deer that's on in pens, and that particular pen may not have been pressured all year, and they're feeding the deer in a certain place, and you can kill them outside the rut in daylight hours. And every now and then, we'll find a buck that we can do that with. Just there is a few bucks that has a personality trait to move during daylight outside the rut. In my area, in everybody's area, and on public ground. I think talent is a trait that's passed down from one generation to another. And after bucks learn the danger of the human predator in pressured areas, they start traveling at night, they pass that trait down. Well, there's a few bucks that just is just governed by personality to move outside the rut during daylight. Those bucks generally get killed by the time they're 1.5 or 2.5 and at the most 3.5 years old. That is why it is really important, if you can, and if you get an opportunity to hunt a ground, say public ground or private ground that's never been opened before for hunting, if you can get in there and hunt that, you will have a gold mine, because there will be a goodly number, a few bucks that has reached 6.5 or 7.5 year olds that has not been hunted all their life, and they have that trait to move outside the rut during daylight. I've only killed one before October 25th, and it was a big deer named Rattlesnake that I killed at 7.5 years old. And from the time the deer was 2.5 on, I noticed he had this trait. When he was 4.5 years old, a week and a half or 2 weeks after he shed his velvet, I got plenty of pictures of him during daylight. Now, when they're still in velvet, all of them will be out in the feeding fields, no matter how old and how nocturnal, they'll be out in the field. I'm not talking about in July and August. A lot of them will be out in the fields during daylight, during that time in food plots. But once they shed that velvet, they become an animal, a different creature. And then is when you have to be concerned about hunting them. And by then, most of them turn nocturnal until the rut. So I wanted to clarify a few things about that. Okay, so the general deer population, that's does and fawns and young bucks, are diurnal in their movements. And the older the bucks get, the more nocturnal they become outside the rut. When I say diurnal, they're dust movers. They move at daylight and dust. And because we hunt does before the rut and maybe kill harvested for meat, and because a lot of people start out hunting does, then they get used to seeing deer bed down, being diurnal, and then bedding down about 9 or 10 o'clock. And that preconditions us to think that deer, even during the rut, don't move in the middle of the day. And it preconditions us to believe that any time during the year, during October, say, we can kill a mature buck outside the rut. And that's just not the case. In a moderately to heavy hunted area, deer that do possess that trait are killed by the time they're 3.5. So very few of us, just so happened that one deer I was keeping tabs of didn't make it to 7.5, but, and that was some other people hunting the area, but he, through luck and just his intelligence and ability, he was able to elude them and get by. But I killed him on October 1st and he was 7.5 years old. So that's every now and then. That will happen, but you should never blind hunt a mature buck outside the rut. Never. Now, when I say blind hunt, I mean if you, like me, get pictures of him or happen to see him a couple of times outside the rut, then you know that that deer is one of those rare creatures that has that trait, and you can try to figure him out and hunt him outside the rut. But I'm telling you, if he's not been pulled by that rut urge, he is an animal of extreme cunning, and he... it would be amazing if he don't detect your presence or outwit you even when you get him coming in close. So I just wanted to make that comment before I press so much this issue of not hunting a mature buck until the rut. Even one that is occasionally moving during daylight outside the rut, in my opinion, your chances are much better if you wait to October 25th, if it's seasonally cooler and or later on. In my area, of course, that's. But now you can apply that to where you hunt also. But the thing about the rut is, because most mature bucks are nocturnal, it takes something out of the ordinary to get them on their feet during daylight hours. Other than forced movement, the only thing that I can think of and the most obvious thing is the rut. And during the rut, it is my belief that all mature bucks and older age class bucks will be on their feet at one point or another during the breeding season. That's just the nature of the game. the urge to procreate is so strong that that's just going to, and been osmosis, that it's just always been the case. But let me say this, not only is it less productive, you're just kind of wasting your time hunting mature bucks before the rut movement. Hunting a mature buck during this time of season, say once season opens down to October 25th, and that's north of the parallel, that's the 35th parallel line, it will destroy your chances to kill one. I believe this is one of the major reasons a lot of people do not kill a mature buck, and they absolutely have no idea why. They literally run that buck off before he's moving during daylight. They're setting up on big signs. And they're hunting him. Let me illustrate how the average deer hunter hunts and why his action diminishes his chance of shooting a mature buck. Most bow hunters will start hunting on opening day, which is usually the last week of September or the first week of October. And he'll hunt every chance he gets early in the season because, you know, the anticipation's been building, and he's like all of us with this urge. He just wants to go hunting. And a week or two into October, the guy set up in a good place, he knows what he's doing, and large buck sign will start showing up around the hunter's stand or on his route to the stand. And these large rubs and stripes will really get the hunter excited. He'll hunt even harder, and he'll spend every free minute he has in the woods because he's wanting to kill this monster buck that's making the big sign. Well, after a few days of hunting and not seeing the big buck that's tearing the woods up, he'll begin to get frustrated. This is when the average deer hunter will usually start scouting again. He'll walk the woods out to make sure he's set up in the right location, and then he'll continue to hunt his previous stand, or maybe he'll hunt another stand on some more big sign 200 or 300 yards down the same buck's travel corridor. The typical deer hunter, I tell you what he'll also do, he'll also shoot a young buck or a doe or two because he's getting frustrated now. It's, say, the third week of October, and he's not seeing the big buck that's tearing the woods up, and he's getting frustrated, so he don't want to go through the season without shooting something. He'll shoot a doe or two from eight or maybe a younger buck, and, of course, that'll require him dragging it out of the woods and walking through the woods some more and leaving more human scent in the woods. And a lot of times he'll even solicit the help of a friend or a hunting partner who may be hunting the same buck a quarter mile away to have him drag the deer he shot out. And by the third or fourth week of October, the hunter is really discouraged. Not only is he not seen that big buck, and he knows he's in the area, all deer sign. He's seeing fewer and fewer deer of any kind and fewer deer sign of any kind. But I want to ask you, is it any wonder that this is the case? He has left enough scent in the area and disturbed the general deer population and disturbed the ground so much that the 1.5-year-old deers are going to place. And at this time, the most deer hunters will get so discouraged enough, they'll either quit hunting or quit hunting that spot and start hunting a new location. And they may have had a 180-inch buck pinpointed. Well, I'm telling you, fellas, hunting in this manner, the typical deer hunter has never killed a mature buck and never will unless it's purely by luck. And why is he not successful hunting in this manner? It's because his target buck become aware that he was being stalked. And he has literally educated that buck to the fact that you're after his hide, and he has destroyed his chances of killing him. And there's many ways that hunting a buck too early like this, a mature buck that's nocturnal, there's many ways that you can destroy your chances. And let me go over about five reasons here, and we can learn something from each one of these. Well, of course, during the night, that mature bucks keep a close check on what's taking place in the different family groups of does in their home range. So they're traveling around at night, and they're making big rubs and scrapes during these locations and on the travel door corridors between them during this time. And in either or both of these locations is where the typical deer hunter encounters this sign, and he's hunting, and he's getting excited about it. And during the night, the old buck that was tearing the woods up is coming through, and every few nights he passes through that area, and he encounters fresh human scent because the hunter was coming in and out of a stand and walking around scouting some more. And every few nights he encounters fresh human scent. And after two or three such encounters, we don't have to go past number one of my 5 points, but after two or three such encounters, that mature buck has wrote that off as a dangerous situation because he knows the human predator is after him. No respectable buck would keep going into that area after encountering fresh human scent two or three times. Now, I'm going to chase a rabbit hole, just a sideline here, to point this out even more. Every now and then, I'll have a situation where I have to scout during the season. It just seems to arise every year, but most of my scouting is done the year or 3 years before, and I'm keeping tabs on the buck and the year before. But every now and then, I'll be asked to hunt a new area or a new place to open up, and I'll have a situation to scout in the season or very close to season. And, fellas, I will not go in but one time. When I go into an area, the local deer herd and the mature bucks, if there's any in that particular location, they'll ease out. They'll accept that. They encounter people all the time, squirrel hunters, coon hunters, mushroom hunters, hikers. They'll accept that. They'll move out. They'll come in back at night after you leave, and they'll smell around and track you around and figure out where you spent most of the time and try to figure out what was going on there. And of course, they don't think like us, so they don't really know, but they're very aware that it could be a predator, human predator. Well, a lot of people will go in and scout like that, and they'll find good sign and maybe want to walk it some more the next day, or at least go back. They're tired, it's late, and they'll go out that night, and then they'll come back the next day and hang their stands. Well, the next time they go in, the next day, they push those deer back out again. And now that's too much. That's alarming. That's no longer a squirrel hunter walking through, or a hiker, or a coon hunter. When they push them out a second day, 2 days in a row, or maybe the next day, or 2 days apart, when the same, and they come back in, and it's the same human scent in the same location, that is alarming to a deer, very alarming to a mature buck. They don't get to be mature by being stupid, and most people underestimate them and don't know what it takes to kill one. That's why they don't. But when I go in and scout a new area, if it's close to season or during the season, I will leave no rock unturned. I will walk at daylight to dark, and I don't care if it's after dark. I will go out and get my stands and bring them back in. I do not want to push the deer out 2 days in a row or the next day, and I don't want to disturb them, but one time. They'll accept that, but no more. Okay. Having said that, let me move forward to the second reason, the second way a mature buck gets tipped off that you're hunting a certain area because you're hunting too early. You're not waiting until he actually is moving during daylight and sneaking there and set up, and it's the first time or second time that stand's been hunted. You're hunting him constantly too early because you found the big sign and you've got excited about it, but the buck's nocturnal. That buck may be tipped off by an old doe that has become aware of the location of your stand. I know you guys have, and I have many times watched a doe come down the corridor I'm hunting and become aware of my presence. Maybe I moved at the wrong time or the wind shifted or something, and she may have 5 or 6 those behind her, and she will communicate through body language. She won't, not blowing and running yet, but she'll do something that I don't even notice, but she'll communicate to the deer behind her that there's danger up her head. There's a human predator, and they'll all stop, and then one of them start stomping their foot but before you know it, they blow and run off. It's my opinion, and I think I've seen stuff that's indicated this, that old doe that's found you in that stand don't only tip deer off right then to your presence, particularly if she has done it a couple of days in a row or a couple of days in a week. It's my opinion that anytime during the nightly visit she's in that area or that location and she's with other deer, she will let them know through body language that, hey, we're not going through this corridor. We're not going down this patch of woods because there's danger in there. And before you know it, every doe and every deer in the woods is become aware of your presence, even and even the old mature bucks that was in the area at the time. Well, that's the second way that a mature buck can be tipped off because you've hunted him too early in the year. And the third way is by using his nose, a mature buck will discover that the deer traveling through a corridor reaches a certain point and they make a detour, which is not normal. They did this because they were spooked by you or by the airborne scent they smelt you or by the scent you left behind walking in and out. They've learned that a human predator's in them woods, and that's why you're seeing fewer deer. Well, this old buck is coming down that same corridor, and he knows the family group of does there just like he comes through there all the time at night, every few days. And he knows them just like you know your own family's movements. And if your family all of a sudden started avoiding a certain place, you would know it. Well, through his nose, he's following the family group of does in a normal pattern. And all of a sudden, he's walking further, and there's no doe scent. He smells the ground. No deer scent at all. He circles, smells a wider area, and no deer scent at all. I believe that buck knows and has learned through experience that those does have deterred their normal movement and are moving around a certain place because there's danger there. So he'll start avoiding the area, of course, just like he would if he found two or three different times of your scent. He's going to stop avoiding that area. So that's another way. After two or three nights of detecting danger for whatever reason, he's going to stay away. And he's an ultimate survival machine. He's just not going to make a stupid mistake like that after such encounters. He may relocate to a faraway place, but for sure he's going to avoid going through that location. And the fourth way a mature buck may be tipped off that you're hunting a certain area that he normally likes to go through, it's on his travel corridor, it's a good place to kill him, but you're hunting him too early in the year, is that he may be bedded in the half mile, or he may be bedded 3/4 of a mile away from a certain ridge or a funnel you're hunting. And as your hunt continues, you occasionally spook deer, does, young bucks, whatever, going to and fro of your stand. And of course, those deer leave quickly, and they give that familiar warning. They blow, and then that's just like a hunter sitting half a mile from somebody else hunting, and you two or three days in a row, you hear deer blowing on a certain ridge. Well, you know somebody's hunting up there. Hmm. And the young bucks and does become aware of your presence. Maybe they catch you in a tree stand and blow. Maybe they blow when you're going in and out. Well, the mature buck that's bedded in hearing of that location, I'm telling you, he is going to write that off. I'm no longer going through there. He's left sign there. It's a good place for him, but he's no longer going through there. I'm hoping through these situations, you can begin to see why many of you all and my readers, my listeners are failing in their attempt to kill a mature buck. They're hunting them too early in the season. They get excited and they do not use restraint. Well, the fifth reason a lot of people don't tip off a mature buck and don't kill him by hunting. The fifth reason hunting too early in the season can cost you that is, even if your target buck does not suspect danger, he will not hang around a place long in the fall where there is no or few does because the hunter has spooked them all out of that location. You can't hunt a place a week in a row unless you use extreme stealth. And there's very few hunters that can hunt a place a week in a row without the family group of does becoming aware of your presence. That's why it's much easier to hunt a place that has very few does, because once they do become aware of your presence, as I stated before, there's many ways that they can tip off a mature buck will also become aware of. But anyway, once the family group of does become aware of your presence, and they vacate the location, that buck will come through at night. Even if he don't go right through your corridor and detect your scent or where you've been or understand some of the other reasons, that mature buck will come through at night, and he's feeding on acres, and he's walking around where he knows the rut's coming up, and he's trying to keep a check of this family group of does and find out where they're located most often and where they're using, and he don't find any. If you're looking for a date and go to a bar or event, where there are none or very few of the opposite sex, you're not going to stay there long. And you probably won't return, at least for a good while. So you'll probably keep scouting around until you find a place where there is a lot of the opposite sex attended.
Yeah.
So if you overhunt a place, and if you're in there before the buck is pulled into daylight by the rut movement period, and you're spooking the local does, and they're no longer going on that ridge or going through that area, and a mature buck comes through at night a time or two, and there's no does, he's going to write that off as just a low chances of success of what he's trying to achieve. And when he finds an area over here where they move to, that's they got a lot more does, then that's where he's going to spend his time. Well, as you can see from, I hope, what I've said, it makes matters, to begin with, it decreases your chances so much that you just as well, in a heavily hunted or modern hunted area or public ground, it decreases your chance so much that it's just about not worth it anyway, hunting a mature buck outside the rut. And not only does it decrease your chances of success, the damage you will do would literally, in any one of these five ways, run that mature buck off or make him look for places elsewhere to go. So I hope this point of hunting the rut, number one, and why it's so important to stay out of the woods until the rut movement pulls him, I hope I have been able to point that out to you and your listeners, fellas.
Yeah, that's absolutely, like, so much detail in that. I did have a couple of questions, and I'll ask them all together because they're kind of related. But number one, could you tell me what your definition age-wise is of a mature buck? And also with that, can you also tell me, like, is there any scenario outside of weather where you will even be in the woods before that time period? I know you said that the weather largely affects, or the cold weather largely affects that October 25th date. Do you just not hunt, period, or do you go out and maybe try to get lucky on some spots that maybe you know you don't have a buck targeted? So yeah, age for mature buck, and is there a scenario where you do hunt early season?
Well, getting lucky, hunting a mature buck early in the season, hoping to get lucky in a buck maybe I hadn't targeted, or just hoping to get lucky on a mature buck, is 100% out of the question because of the five reasons I have just brought up.
Yeah.
All you're going to do is educate him. If you have him up on some sign and just think, well, I don't know this particular deer, and since it ain't over there where I want to hunt another one, I'm going to go ahead and give him a try. Well, that's a major mistake, just as much as it would be if it was the buck you had targeted. I hunt outside the rut on edge of fields and stuff in a particular place outside of, away from where I want to hunt a mature buck, just to kill does and enjoy hunting and shoot those for meat. Of course, I do that. And as far as buck age, I try not to shoot a buck until he's 5 and a half. But now I know the bucks I'm hunting. That's what I'm kind of known for in my articles and stuff, is targeting a particular buck. And you'd be amazed at the bucks I have watched grow up through the years that become 5 and a half, 6 and a half, 7 and a half in Tennessee and never reach trophy status for me, 150. Deer and 116 sometimes. In Tennessee, the average 4 and a half or 5 and a half year old 8 point would not get out of the low 140s, and a 10 point even out of the 150s. It takes an exceptional buck, and I have watched literally a ton of deer grow to trophies age and never develop into what I wanted to shoot. Very few bucks in Tennessee that I've followed and watched grow up did I kill, and once they get 5 and a half, if they're not what I want, I move on looking at something else and maybe watching two or three other bucks. So 5 and a half for me. Now, a lot of people will go ahead and shoot a 5 and a half year old knowing he's a 5 and a half year old, but I'm just fascinated by a lot of horn, and if he's in the 140s, I'll put my efforts elsewhere. A lot of people call 3 and a half year olds mature because that's all they can kill. A lot of the mature bucks that you see killed on TV that are call bucks are actually 2 and a half year olds, sometimes 1 and a half, or sometimes 3 and a half. They just have to, you know, make shows and promote products. So they'll say that's an old buck that's just a call buck, and he really ain't old enough to be mature and have a good racks, usually the case. I love shooting 6.5 and 7.5 year old bucks, but sometimes I'll shoot them at 5.5, but hardly ever before that.
Okay. And do you, when you go out and you target specific bucks and you're obviously planning to kill them during the rut or during that time period, what would you say is like an average number of bucks that you're chasing each season? Do you say, I'm just going to target this one buck and that's it? Or do you have multiple areas where you have multiple target bucks per season?
I will only target one buck. Now, if something happens to him and I think I only want to shoot one buck a year and I've got that buck in mind, I'll put my time and effort there. But if I know that he has a second home range that he spends a lot of time doing the rut, and if he disappears and I've got another one in a place that I can hunt, then I may move over to that one and I'll continue monitoring my cameras. Now, used to, I just use sign, but I'll continue monitoring my cameras until he returns. But normally I just want to shoot one buck and I put all my effort in that. But fellas, don't get locked into a stand when that deer is not at home. You may be in the right stand and right location, but he may be in his other home range and he's just not at home, and you are really wasting your time there until he comes home. Of course, you may sit there a week, then he may pop up and you've got it. That's the best situation. If I don't have another mature buck to hunt, I'm totally happy to take that chance.
Yeah.
And to wait on him. So, I may have one in one property where his core area is, and core area consists of about 160 acres or something. Or I may have two on that one property that has a core area. Sometimes that's pretty rare because I don't have a lot of big properties to hunt. But let me tell you how I find their core area. It might be interesting another rabbit hole we can go down here. I put on all the hunting properties I have available to me, I put mineral licks, and it's still legal in a lot of states, and I put mineral licks beside all the thickest cover on the properties. I don't care if it's an acre and a half or if it's 10 acres, I'll put mineral licks beside the thickest, roughest cover on that particular property, because the most mature bucks will be in that inaccessible cover. And I'll put mineral licks around every one of them. And then I'll put my cameras on them in late July. Now, when I get a picture of a mature buck on a mineral lick close to thick cover that time of year, I know for a fact that that buck lives there. That's his core area. Because in July, the rut is not pulled him, and he will not be moving far. Now, he may relocate in his home range to a prime food source in April and May and feed there because, say, soybeans or something. But he will move back by July and August when that dries up. He will move back to his core area. And when I get a picture of a mature buck in July, that buck is not probably traveling over 160, 200 acres. I know I have found his core area. It's in that thicket that I have put the mineral lick beside. I read an article years ago by a guy that said that when you find a big rub in late August or late September or early October when they first shed the velvet, it don't mean anything. He wants to see them big rubs in November. Well, I take subject with that. I believe that it's right the opposite. When you find a big rub in November, that buck could be a mile and a half or 5 miles if it's in another core area, but he could definitely be a mile and a half from there in his home range. But if you find a big rub where right after they shed their velvet in late September, early October, that buck is still in his core area, and that buck has not traveled far, and you have found his core area just as you have when you get a picture of one in July and August. So it's very important to find a buck's core area and know where he lives. And then, of course, we'll start looking for funnels, and which is my next subject. We'll start looking for a tree to hunt in that core area. Has that raised any questions in your mind?
And no, I mean, I completely agree with you, and I've actually had that conversation quite a bit pretty recently just about finding core areas this time of the year when they're traveling a pretty good bit less than they will other times of the year. You know, if I go and I put a trail camera out right now, and within a couple of weeks I don't have the pictures that I want. I maybe don't have the deer that I would like to see. I'm probably going to move it for that reason. Because if it's not there in his core area, then I'm just wasting my time this time of year if I don't have him in that amount of time. Because I just don't feel like they're traveling an ultra long distance right now. And so, you know, I just, if I'm not finding the sign or something like that, like I just typically am not going to waste my time for that reason. So I think that that's good to think about. You know, if you're finding the stuff that you're wanting to find right now, this time of season, if you're finding those, you know, if you find a scrape that's open or a big rub, man, to me, that makes perfect sense that you are in his core area this time of year. Is that basically what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Now, that don't mean that you're going to kill him there during the rut. That's not where I'm going to hunt him.
Exactly.
But it does. If you lose a buck and lose his sign and he's not showing up, his sign's not showing up in a tight funnel where you're hunting him, it's always good to go back to his core and start there and see if he's home or if he's perhaps in another home range. So, yeah, that's basically what I'm saying. And I will hunt him. Now, this thing about late October, people talk about rubs and scrapes. I've wrote a lot of articles and stuff. I kind of, I'm one of the first hunters to start using scrapes and really use them effectively. And you can Google and find some articles I've wrote on scrapes and rubs. But I make a lot of mock scrapes. But people often ask me, will I, talking about hunting early in the year, will I hunt mock rubs and scrapes? I will. And I've killed some good deer on scrape lines and rubs, and they're basically the same thing. They're showing you a travel corridor, and there's a purpose for them. But we won't get into all that. We don't have time. But the only time I will hunt, the only time hunting a scrape, 90% of the time it's going to be effective is from October 25th if it's unseasonably cool till November 1st or 2nd or 3rd. That's a very, people hunt scrapes a lot. They don't have much success, but they're hunting them before that period or after that period. When those bucks get pulled later than in my area in the Midwest, later than October 25th, when they get pulled into daylight, until the first wave of does come in about November 3rd or 4th, there's a short, very short period of time there you can effectively hunt scrapes. Outside that, you're educating the deer and wasting your time. But I thought I would throw that in too.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Here, especially in the South, man, I don't know if you've noticed that the hunting scrapes in the South is, and I don't know if it would be so much for like the age class of deer that you're referring to versus, you know, the three and a half, 4.5 year old deer that most people would be okay with. But I have found for me that pretty much any time of the season, I don't see a lot of deer on scrapes. Early season, if I hunt a scrape early season and I can find one that's close to bedding, is typically the time when I'm going to see the most deer. But any other time, I just don't typically see that, which makes a lot of sense hearing you talk, because there's really only maybe a week right there when it can be, you know, more effective. And if you're not hunting during that week, then sure, you're not going to. It may not be effective for you. Like you said, you may just be educating. That kind of is what it seems like you're saying.
Correct. He's still coming through early in October, but it's good night, and you have educated him to your location and the five reasons you've educated him when you're hunting anywhere. You've educated him, and by the time he would be moving in daylight, you run him off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the fact. That's why most people are not productive hunting scrapes or rub lines.
Oh, man, I hate to cut you guys off right now because I know you're just getting into this and it feels like we just started and it's already been so much good information, but I have to cut it off so that we can have part two, and I think part two is going to get good. So let me know what you guys thought about Bobby Worthington even before you listen to the rest of it. Me personally, he could have stopped talking 10 minutes into the conversation, I would have felt like I've learned a ton. So I'd love to hear your guys' feedback. You can post it up on Facebook, send me a private message on the Southern Ground Facebook page or on Instagram, whatever you want to do. That's at Southern Ground Hunting on both Facebook and Instagram. You can find us
Again, remember that we are giving away a Tethered Phantom. All you got to do is subscribe on YouTube. I'm posting a ton of content right now on YouTube. It's older content, getting it on the new channel. So if you are looking for something to do right now while we're trying to get fired up for deer season, go watch those. I hope they'll fire you up. I really do. I know they fired me up. So, yeah, that's going to be it for this weekend. You guys have a great weekend. If you're going to be out in the woods, remember that God gave you dominion over the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and the beasts of the earth. So go out and exercise that dominion. Talk to you next time.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.